T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
A commission is looking into the selective service system. Is it working? Should it be expanded to include women? What about a draft? What about drafting women? What about making the registration voluntary or eliminating it? And the chairman of the commission is nice enough to join us now, Dr. Joe Heck, chairman of the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Tommy.
I appreciate your time. I really do. And this whole thing fascinates me. Tell me where we are, I guess, how we went from the draft, if we can maybe set the stage a little bit. We had a draft, then we didn't, then it turned to registration, and where we are now in terms of women, et cetera.
Sure. Well, so the draft officially ended back in 1972, post-Vietnam, and actually was disestablished. In 1980, President Carter reestablished the requirement for men between the ages of 17 and 26 to register for the Selective Service System in the event of a need for a draft in response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Now, we haven't had a draft, however, since 1972, but the Selective Service Registration requirement is still on the books, and men who don't register are liable for penalties like the inability to get student federal financial aid or get a federal job. Women had not been required to register, and in fact, by law, are prohibited from registering because it was believed that the role of the Selective Service System, if it was used for a draft, would be to provide combat replacements. And previously, women were not allowed to participate in combat roles. However, that was that prohibition was repealed in 2015, and so since women are now permitted to participate in all roles in the military, the question was posed, should women now have to register for the Selective Service System? So to answer that question, Congress chartered this commission to look at the broader issue of, one, do we even still need a Selective Service System? If so, should women have to register? And are there any modifications necessary to the system to better reflect the potential needs of the Department of Defense in the 21st century?
I called you Dr. Joe Heck. I don't know if that was more respectful than General Joe Heck. I don't know, but I'll call you Dr. General, I guess. Tell me about the thought process as it relates to, I think you can make cases for, against, on either side, as it relates to an all-volunteer military as opposed to people being drafted. I think one of the things that is a misnomer is that while there were plenty of people lining up to register to fight for the country in World War II, there was a considerable draft that went on as well, was there not?
There certainly was. And so that's the issue as we have now changed to an all-volunteer force since the mid-70s. And DOD, the Department of Defense, will willingly state that they have no plans to ever utilize a draft. The question is, do we still need the Selective Service System then? And, you know, there's about a $24 million a year price tag associated with maintaining this system that has not been used since the mid-70s. What they have said, though, is that it's a great low-cost insurance policy, right, in the event that we would have a major theater war where we would need to conscript a large number of folks. So this is an insurance policy to help provide that. They also claim that it's a way to maintain a connection between the general population and the military. However, we have found that most men who now register don't even know they registered, because it becomes almost automatic when they go to get their driver's license or they apply for financial aid. And then we've talked to members of the military through all ranks that have said, you know, they don't want draftees in the foxhole with them, because we have never had a more professional force than we have today, and they'd rather have somebody who is committed to fighting and serving than somebody who's potentially there against their will. And so those are some of the questions that the commission is exploring.
I would think, and I've never been in the military, and I admire those that have, yourself including, but I would think if you're in a battle theater, whether you're there voluntarily or not would be the least of your priorities at that point, or am I making something up there?
Well, you know, certainly in Vietnam, World War II was one thing, Korea similar, but Vietnam, as we know, looking at history, there was a bit of a difference between those that were drafted and those that had volunteered to serve. We had many more problems with draftees during the Vietnam era than we had previously in World War II, and I think that was just a generational shift, you know, between the 1940s and the 1960s. But when you talk to those that currently serve of all ranks, they feel that the all-volunteer force is the most professional, capable, ready warfighting force that we've ever had. And so we need to look at, you know, whether or not it's worth keeping this program in place as that low-cost insurance policy, should we ever have a major theater war like we had in World War II? And if so, should women have to register? And should it be modified in some way that better reflects the potential needs of the military? We may not need combat replacements. We may need people that have IT cyber skills. We may need healthcare professionals. Right now, there's no way of knowing what the skills are of the person who has registered.
In terms of, General, looking at whether or not it's worth the money in terms of registration for the draft, I know you talked about professional fighting force. Does the nature of warfare today factor into this anywhere in terms of it would be more cyber or more drone, I guess, however I'm trying to say it, instead of actual boots on the ground?
Yeah, certainly the evolving nature of warfare over the last several decades will put an increased reliance on higher technology, more intensive IT-related skills, which will change the composition of the force that goes to war. And so that, again, is one of the reasons why the study that we're conducting is looking at whether or not, if we keep the selective service system, if it should be modified in a way that better identifies the potential skills that the nation may need. Now, the other thing that this commission is doing, which I think is just as, if not more important, is looking at how do you actually increase the propensity to serve or the ethos toward service amongst all Americans, but particularly targeted at the young group, the 17 to 24-year-old, in order to want to serve their nation either in the military or through national and public service. And so we are embarking on a series of public hearings over the next several months to vet potential policy recommendations on the issue of the selective service and the draft, but also how do we encourage more individuals to participate in our representative democracy by providing some form of service back to their community, their state, or their country.
It seems to me as we talk here that it's not mutually exclusive, that you could have somebody providing public service, spending 2 years perhaps, in a military context, but not necessarily in the military. And I'm talking about cyber security, et cetera.
Certainly, we are looking at a whole host of potential service opportunities for those who want to give back to their community, state, or country. And I think, you know, one of the things where, unfortunately, there's been a disconnect growing in the younger population is their perception of the military as being nothing but, you know, a rifle-toting, war-fighting organization. But no matter what job you may want or have in the civilian sector, that job is also available in uniform. And we need to break through some of the misconceptions and the myths about the military that are propagated by TV shows and Hollywood and make sure that people understand there's more ways to serve in uniform than just carrying a rifle and being part of the fighting force. And so, again, when we look at how do we increase the propensity to serve or create a greater ethos toward service amongst all service lines, we want to make sure that every American is inspired and eager to serve in whatever way suits them in order to give back to the country.
In terms of being invested, I guess the way I look at it is if you look at programs like Habitat for Humanity, and I don't want to get off in that area at all, but as an example, you know, you need sweat equity, right? You gotta work on the house to develop some pride in it. That's the thought process, and then you take care of it. And I'm just wondering, in terms of mandatory service, would that, A, get the young people, you're talking about, you know, 21 years old, I'm not ancient, but I'm not 21 either. Would that get them perhaps more interested in the nation and the challenges that it faces and some of the things that need to be done in order to maintain the country?
Well, that's a great question, Tommy, because over the first year of the commission's existence, we have traveled the country, all 9 census districts, 15 states, 24 cities, met with over 300 organizations, talking about what inspires people or motivates people to serve and what are some of the obstacles or barriers they face in service. And, you know, fortunately, what we found is that there is a strong desire amongst all age groups to want to serve their country and to give back to their communities. But what we have also found is that there's a general lack of awareness of potential service opportunities, or there are obstacles or barriers, primarily in the social economic sector, that prevents people from serving. And so we want to break down those barriers. We want to make sure that there is increased awareness, more opportunity, and encourage greater participation across military, national, and public service. Because we feel at a time where the country is divided, service is a great opportunity to serve as a uniter of people that brings people together from different demographics that may not have known each other previously, similar to what happens in the military when you get a bunch of raw recruits at boot camp and how they bond. You can do that through any type of service. And that's one way that we can help restore the unity of this country.
In terms of, accumulating this data, processing it, how do you go about all of this? Seems like a Herculean measure to try to undertake.
Yeah, it is a monumental task. And so we've spent the first year, as I mentioned, on a listening tour, traveling around the country, gathering public information through town halls all across this great land. We have a very strong research staff that is looking at all of the previous studies that have been done in this area. We are now in our second year, and in phase two, we begin a series of formal public hearings where we now will take some of the potentially policy recommendations that we have developed and vet them with the general public, with subject matter experts that are in service, with academics. We have heard from thousands of Americans over the course of the first year. We need to hear from thousands more because we want to make sure that the recommendations we make to Congress, the president, and the American people are truly representative of what the American people want.
Nothing is free, and as we talk about maybe everybody doing 2 years of, and it's just an idea at this point, obviously, of doing 2 years of service, be it in the military or whatever they have to offer to the country, that's going to cost some money. Somebody's going to have to pay them. So what are the outlooks on that? That's part of what you're looking at and discussing?
Certainly. So, you know, there is the opportunity to expand the national service programs like Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, Teach for America, Senior Corps that are already in place and doing great work every day all across the country. That certainly will come with a price tag. We're also exploring public-private partnerships. There's a growing trend within corporations around America, around the idea of corporate social responsibility and the creation of corporate foundations that provide service in their local communities. And so is there a way to do a public-private partnership that matches individuals with a certain skill set or a certain desire to give back in a particular way with one of those private entities that are already providing services in those local communities? Certainly that would be much less expensive to the federal treasury. And then there's just the growing volunteerism, right? There are folks that will go to their local food bank or soup kitchen or homeless shelter and take time out of their own day and out of their own life at no cost to anybody in order to give back. And we want to make sure that people are aware of the multitude of ways in order to serve their city, their state, their country, and then to break down the barriers to that service so, again, that every American is eager and inspired to serve.
Yeah, because I guess the other side of it, and again, you're talking about, do you only do 2 years? What do you get in terms of benefits for putting your 2 years in? I guess something else you all are looking at, if you extend it beyond 2 years and make it a career, then you're looking at veterans and veterans' benefits. And I guess the other thing is maybe, General, if I understand you, that if you make it a mandatory 2 years and people get paid for this, however they do, then it would in effect, in a way, cannibalize some of the people that are volunteering right now, the people that would be eligible for this age-wise, saying, well, you know what, if I'm going to get paid for it, I may as well do it that way.
Well, we certainly have heard from folks on both sides of the issue of mandatory national service, and those who believe that it should remain, an all-volunteer type of endeavor with an educational stipend or some living stipend to help offset the cost of service, just for the reasons that you mentioned. You know, some folks feel that it's the spirit of volunteerism which has really made America as great a nation as it is, and do we want to now force people to do something which takes away from that spirit of volunteerism? So, we are looking at what we call universal access, which is providing an opportunity for everybody who wants to serve, a universal expectation where over the course of a generation it is expected that somebody will serve in a given way for a certain period of time, although it would remain voluntary, or a universal obligation where everybody is required to serve for a certain period of time in an endeavor that best meets their needs. And so that's some of the information that we will be seeking as we go out through the series of public hearings over the course of the next 6 months.
And finally, in terms of buying into the country, being invested in it, I would think if mothers and fathers have their sons and daughters that are suddenly involved in this, then maybe warfare, public policy wouldn't just be an abstract concept. They'd take a real interest in this.
Well, that certainly has been talked about since we've done away with the draft, and military service is a responsibility borne by few when less than 1% of the U.S. population currently serves in uniform, roughly 2.4 million people in the active and reserve components, perhaps our elected leaders would be a little bit more thoughtful and cognizant of committing our sons and daughters to war if it was their sons and daughters that were potentially going off to war.
General, appreciate your time. I think it's be fascinating to watch this unfold. And will the commission be giving regular, semi-regular updates, or will the results be released when the study's over?
Yeah, so certainly we encourage people to go to our website, which is inspire2serve.gov. That's inspire, the number 2, serve.gov. We just issued our interim report this past month, which talks about who we are, what we learned, and what we are considering. And then we will issue a final report to the Congress, President, and American people in March of 2020, which will lay out the agreed-to policy recommendations on how we inspire every American to serve.
General, I appreciate your time.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.